Hello there and Merry Christmas. Every year at Paradox, I write a letter to my son and to my daughter because their birthdays are close to Christmas, and I give it as a sermon for our Christmas series at Paradox. And this week's teaching is entitled, Dear Bodhi. Before we get to the letter, I just want to give two qualifiers that help to frame what this letter actually is. The first qualifier is this. I am writing this letter to my two-year-old son with the intention that he will read it later in life. A letter to a two-year-old would be very short and have lots of pictures, which doesn't make the best podcast. So when I'm writing this letter, I'm not sure when Bodhi will read it. It might be 14, it might be 18, it might be 68. Who knows what age he will be when he actually reads these words. But these words are meant to be a reflection of where I'm at as a parent, watching my son grow from the age of 1 to 2, and what I hope and wish and appreciate about him during this Christmas and birthday season. The second qualifier is this. There are some people who feel that pastors shouldn't talk about their kids too much in a sermon. I hear those critiques and I understand that, but this sermon fails that marker horrifically. This sermon is all about my son. And if you feel like that is wrong or inappropriate, then I will tell you this. This week and next week, when I write a letter to my daughter, are going to be all about my kids. And after those 2 weeks, we'll go back to talking about systemic failures of American Christianity throughout history and what we do to reconcile those in our modern era. So if that's more of your jam, just wait a couple weeks and we'll get there. With those two qualifiers in hand, I invite you to sit back and enjoy this letter that I have titled, Dear Bodhi. Dear Bodhi. On Wednesday, your mother, your sister, and I burst into your bedroom with gusto and sang, Happy Birthday to you. You melted down into tears by the second line because you're two, but we kept on singing. Our hearts were overflowing with unbridled glee. You have brought so much happiness to our family over the past 2 years. My favorite thing about watching you grow from the age of 1 to the age of 2 is how you have started to enjoy life. This past year, we found that you love to ride trains, you love to golf, and you love when your sister puts makeup on you. From December 12, 2016 to December 12, 2018, your mother and I love watching you develop into the person that God created you to be. Just 1 year ago, you couldn't walk, you couldn't talk, and you couldn't express many emotions. Now you chatter relentlessly as you run full tilt into the agonies and ecstasies of the world. Bodhi, you are simultaneously the reason for the bags under my eyes and the first reason I smile every morning. And I love all of you for that. Today, a few days after December 12, I want to tell you happy birthday. And on this same day, a few days before December 25, I want to tell you Merry Christmas. In this letter, I'm going to share the Christmas story with you and then share a wish I have for you as you grow from the age of 2 to the age of 3 and then beyond. This wish is inspired by your life, your birthday, the Christmas story, and it is one of the deepest desires that your mother and I have for you. First, the Christmas story. In his gospel, Matthew writes about an engaged couple, Joseph and Mary. Shortly before their wedding, Mary reveals to Joseph that she is pregnant, not through immaculate conventions, but by immaculate conception. Joseph, confident that the baby is not his, seeks to dismiss Mary quietly. But before Joseph can separate from her, an angel visits him in the dead of night and proclaims, "Do not be afraid." The messenger assures Joseph that Mary's pregnancy is in fact immaculate, that the fetus growing inside of her will one day save all of humanity from their sins, and that Joseph is to name this child Jesus. At this point, the narrator pulls away from the story and writes that this immaculation needs to happen to fulfill a prophecy recorded in Isaiah. Matthew writes, "Look, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall name him Emmanuel," which means God is with us. Joseph wakes up from this vision and obeys the angel. He marries Mary merrily. She gives birth to a baby boy. And Mary and Joseph name their son Jesus. Bodhi, the thesis of Matthew's Christmas story is four words. God is with us. This child is the very presence of God. And while God could have descended from the clouds, riding on a fiery chariot with the windows down and the radio up, blasting a heavy metal rendition of the praise song, "How Great is Our God," God instead chose to be with us by way of vaginal birth. Why? Because God is with us. And we are human beings. And all of us, every one of us, at some point, have been born. The birth of Jesus reminds us that God is with us from the moment we take our first breath outside the womb. Now, Bodhi, let's assume for a moment that you grow up and you choose to believe the Christmas story. You faithfully accept that baby Jesus is the full representation of God's presence, participation, and pleasure with people. What this means on a cellular level is that you will lead a life of hope. Because if the all-powerful, all-loving, all-wonderful creative force behind every star in the sky and every quark in the electrons in our fingernails is with us, then this life is loaded with purpose and direction and meaning and beauty. Life cannot be a futile endeavor if the author of all endeavors is with us. If you are able to look up at the immensity of the universe and gain perspective that you are living on a mere speck of dust in a gooey mess of muscles and tendons held upright by bones in a vast cosmic arena, and somehow still believe that your life and what you do with it matters, well, at that point, Bodhi, you are then living a life of hope. This is the wish that your mother and I have for you today, between your second birthday and your third Christmas. Our wish is that you will live a life of hope. Now, hope is a word that has been neutered by our society. The dictionary defines hope as a feeling of expectation and desire for a certain thing to happen. Which means that if you, Bodhi, were to say, "I am very much looking forward to getting a toy train for Christmas," the dictionary would then respond with, "Well, Bodhi Ray Hadley is a person of hope, because he possesses a feeling of expectation for a toy train." Give me a break. That definition shrivels the human heart with unrelenting dullness. That is the least inspiring understanding of hope that I have ever heard, and it's in the dictionary. I think we can define hope in a way that does not reward materialism. Concurrently, this definition can speak about how hope can be inspiring to you and me. To define hope, we first need to discuss three things that hope requires. These requirements have personally helped me to set tangible goals for what it looks like to live a life of hope in today's world. I have found that if just one of these three requirements are missing, then hope sours into a superfluous exasperation. The first requirement of hope is revealed when we continue to read the Christmas story in Matthew's Gospel. After Jesus is born and named, wise men from the east arrive in Judea to pay respects to the new king of the Jews. How do they know that a new king has been born? Because, get this, Bodhi, they saw a star in the sky. And these wise men somehow thought to themselves, "Oh, a new king of the Jews has been born. See the star?" The problem is, a man named Herod is currently and literally the king of the Jews, which naturally means that Herod is threatened by these wise men, this new star, and a baby. Apparently, when you have more power than you know what to do with, even the arrival of an infant can trigger terrible insecurities. So Herod asks the wise men to find and then disclose where this new king is. The wise men promise Herod that they will comply, and then they leave Herod's court. Once they are outside, the star somehow leads them directly to Jesus. Upon sight of this baby underneath a star, Matthew describes these dignified, scholarly men as being overwhelmed with joy by a child. That evening, an angel visits the wise men and commands them not to speak to Herod. The wise men comply with a stealthy escape out of Judea. A few nights later, another angel visits Joseph and commands him to take his family to Egypt for safekeeping. Joseph complies with a stealthy escape out of Judea. At this point, the story returns to Herod, who becomes enraged that the wise men did not comply. His anger is so blinding that he commands every baby boy age 2 and under in the city of Bethlehem to be ruthlessly slaughtered. Bodhi, we must pause here to feel the full weight of this tragedy. These children were real children with real names, with real hearts, and with real parents. Their lives were ended a few moments after their lives began due to the jealousy of an autocrat. In Matthew's gospel, an angel proclaims God is with us. And a mere 17 verses later, there is a genocide of children. When I read this story 2,000 years later, I cannot ignore the traumatic screams from the parents as their children are ripped away to be stabbed. When most people tell the Christmas story, they fondly recount the gifts of the wise men, but they often skim over the massacre of the infants. There is real pain in the Christmas story. The pain of these mothers, the pain of these fathers, and the pain of these children. Bodhi, one of the most difficult experiences in humanity is for a parent to bury a child. In this story, that immeasurable hardship is compounded by the Judean government betraying her own people with slaughter. The suffering in this story elicits reverence because no amount of words or thoughts or actions could ever justify such a horrific evil. We must never forget that the Christmas story in Matthew is saturated in tears, which is the first requirement of hope. Hope requires tears. This sounds counterintuitive, but let me explain. Bodhi, imagine that you grow up and you boldly proclaim to the world, God is with us. And people hear you and they say, oh yeah, tell me about that. So you proceed to tell them about how you prayed to be successful and God heard your prayers. You got into medical school on your first try. You matched to Johns Hopkins Dermatology. You were their first choice. You go on to have a career that made tons of money and you never once failed a patient and never made a mistake. The people listening to you then ask, how did you pull that off, Bodhi? Well, you say, God is with us. Then someone says, but there's more to life than just success in a career, isn't there, Bodhi? So you tell them about how you prayed to God for meaningful relationships, and God heard your prayers. You found the woman of your dreams at the age of 16. You knew from day one that she was your soulmate, and you weren't even tempted to have sex with her before marriage. You got married, and then you had 3 healthy, perfect, well-behaved kids. Your kids are so good that when you say, "You've had enough screen time today," your kids respond by saying, "Thank you, Father, for looking out for my long-term well-being." The people listening then ask, "How'd you pull that off, Bodhi?" "Well," you say, "God is with us." Then someone says, "But haven't you ever gone to a funeral? Haven't you had to bury someone that you love?" And you proceed to tell them about how you prayed to God to live a life free of pain, and God heard your prayers. God promised you that you wouldn't have to cry any tears. God only gave you healthy friends and family members. Not only that, but you believe that God will return to this earth any minute now before you ever have to say goodbye to a loved one, because God wants to wipe away all of our tears. The people listening will then ask, "How did you pull that off, Bodhi?" "Well," you say, "God is with us." At that point, someone will hear you and yell out, "Bodhi, you are full of crap. Are you even human?" They will say this because tears and loss and rejection and temptation and disease and death and corrupt politicians and greed and lust and pain and betrayal and imperfections are all part of the human experience. Every human being sheds tears at some point in their life. Every household endures suffering. Every heart carries sadness. Therefore, to say God is with us while pretending that all of those heartaches don't exist is a severe breach of faith. When I read the Christmas story in Matthew, the Christmas story that I want to read is that Jesus is born, God is with us, and genocide never happens again. But that's not the Christmas story. The Christmas story instead is about a God who is with us, both when the wise men experience overflowing joy and when Herod enacts unspeakable violence. It's easy to say God is good all the time, and all the time God is good when things are going your way. But what makes hope inspiring is when you have grieved and found that God is just as present in your tears as in your triumphs. This does not mean that you can explain away pain. This does not mean that you can rationally justify suffering. This does not mean that God tests us with heartache. What it means is that you understand that the world can be cruel, and you have been fully present in that cruelty. But from your lips, you still utter a four-word testimony: God is with us. Bodhi, hope without tears is naive. Tears give hope a certain gravity. Tears deeply root hope in the earth that we call home. Tears are what makes hope difficult. And yet tears are what makes hope meaningful. Hope requires tears. May you be a person of great empathy, a person who shares their pain with others and also walks with people in their pain. Which brings us to the second requirement of hope. Bodhi, one thing that your mother and I have learned about you this past year is that you love to play sports. You love to kick a soccer ball. You love to race. You love to throw. You love to swing a bat. And you love to play golf. There's just one problem with this. You are my son, and I am a terrible athlete. What this means is that sports will not come easy to you. I'm sorry for this because I've seen you suffer from deficient athletitis at a young age. Now, people may hear or read this letter and think that I'm being mean, or that I'm being too hard on you, or that I am discouraging you at a young age from pursuing athletics, or that I don't think you can become a great athlete. All of these are false assumptions. I point this out because if you desire to become proficient in sports, which I hope you do, then you are going to have to put in a lot of work. Because you are my son, you aren't going to be able to pick up a golf club and after a few tries, drive the ball 300 yards. Because you are my son, you aren't going to saunter onto a basketball court and start throwing down windmill slams. Because you are my son, you aren't going to pick up a baseball and fling the ball at 97 miles per hour with movement. But if you want to be, I fully believe that you can be great at basketball, golf, or baseball. To get there, you cannot count on your Craig Hadley-given genetic natural athletic ability. Instead, you have to be willing to put the time in and practice, to heed the advice of wise coaches, to work on the fundamentals of sports over and over again, and you have to be willing to sweat a lot, which is the second requirement of hope. Hope requires sweat. I hold on to so many memories of being a kid and eating dinner around a table with my two brothers, my mom, and my dad. During most meals, my dad would try to find some way to work in his life's mantra. At this table, if there was a pause, my dad asked us, "Boys, do you know what's important? You need to work hard and get good grades." We were inundated with this ideal that our purpose from a very young age was to work hard and get good grades. One evening when I was 11 years old, I remember sitting at the dinner table and there was a pregnant pause begging to be delivered by an obstetric mantra. So my dad started in, "Boys, do you know what's important?" And before he could answer his own rhetorical question, we all responded, "We know, we know, we need to work hard and get good grades." My dad looked quite satisfied that we could recite the Hadley Honor Code. But tonight was different, because I looked right back at my dad and said, "Why? Why do we need to work hard and get good grades? Can't we just pass our classes and live a happy life without working that hard or getting that good of grades?" My dad did not recoil as I asked this question. Rather, he beamed with pride, as though he had been waiting for one of us to ask this question from the moment he first mentioned his mantra. "Because, Craig," he said, "you need to leave this world a better place than when you arrived here. You will have the most opportunity to make this world a better place if you get good grades. And to make this world a better place requires hard work. But that hard work is worth waking up for every morning." Pody, do you believe that you can make the world a better place? Because if you do, then you are a hopeful person. But there's a second question I need to ask you. Are you willing to put in the hard work to make this world a better place? Because if your answer is no, then you cease to be a hopeful person and you become a hypocritical person. Hope without sweat is hypocrisy. Are you annoyed with fossil fuel companies who keep dumping ridiculous amounts of carbon into the atmosphere? I'm annoyed too. You can be a scientist who tirelessly searches for renewable energy sources. Are you frustrated by our nation's legal system that is tipped in favor of Caucasians, the wealthy, and men in sexual assault cases? I'm frustrated too. You can be a lawyer who is not concerned with the number of cases you have won, but is concerned with what is just and what is true. Are you discouraged by politicians who tell our country that mass shootings are the result of mental illness, and then those same politicians vote to make healthcare for the mentally ill more expensive and more inaccessible? I'm discouraged too. You can become a politician who is convicted by what is right, rather than being primarily worried about re-election. If those solutions sound like a lot of work, they are. But anything worth having in this life requires sweat. When Jesus Christ matured from a child into a man, he often spoke about the kingdom of God or the kingdom of heaven being close at hand. To Jesus, heaven was not some place that we escape to after death. Instead, Jesus believed that if people had a strong enough desire, that they could experience heaven right here and right now. But heaven isn't handed to us. We have to work toward heaven with everything we have. That work is hard and sweaty work, but it's work that is worth doing. Bodhi, Hope requires sweat. May you be a person who believes that the world can be better. And may you have the courage to wake up daily and work toward heaven here on earth. After tears and sweat, there is a third requirement of hope. Just a few months ago, you discovered something that changed your life. You figured out how to tell a joke. But not just any joke. You stumbled upon the refined literary genre of knock-knock jokes. After Thanksgiving dinner this year, your aunties, your uncles, your grandparents, your mother, and your father sat around the table for 20 uninterrupted minutes as you told knock-knock joke after knock-knock joke. These jokes stopped making sense after about 42 seconds, but you were in your element. The whole time you were smiling as your family burst into laughter at every absurd punchline. Now, a cynic can look at these nonsensical jokes and say, "You know what, Craig? Your son is never going to make a career as a comedian telling knock-knock jokes. Those 20 minutes that you spent with your son around a Thanksgiving table are 20 minutes that you will never get back, because all knock-knock jokes are a waste of time." The cynic may be emboldened by her own words. She may go on to say, "Come on, Craig, think about all the collective suffering in the world. How can you sit there and listen to your son tell pointless jokes while people are in pain? You should leave that table immediately and go help those who are in need. Dinners with your family?" The cynic says they need to be avoided until every person on the planet has enough to eat. Staring at the stars with your romantic partner? The cynic says that needs to wait until there is marriage equality for all. Going to see a comedy show? The cynic says comedy is a distraction from our impending deaths. These ideals may make sense on paper. But Bodhi, I want you to know that if you live your life this way, that you can only enjoy your life after suffering has been absolved, then you will end up jaded, cynical, pessimistic, and burnt out. Bodhi, your mother and I long for you to become a person of hope. Hope requires that you stay in touch with suffering, that you work to make the world a better place. But you are not a machine. You are a human being. And you cannot make the world a better place all the time. You need to take time out of your busy schedule and simply enjoy. This is why we pause one day a week and keep Sabbath, to remind ourselves to enjoy the lives that God has given to us. Which brings us to the third requirement for hope. Hope requires laughter. Laughter is something we do when we are savoring the pleasure of life. We aren't searching for a deeper meaning. We aren't trying to make the world a better place. We are simply enjoying the goodness of what it means to be alive. Without laughter, our lives become a chore. You can believe that this world needs to be better, but if you never take time to find this world enjoyable, then what exactly are you trying to improve? Hope without laughter is despair. Laughter reminds us that we are blessed, that God and this universe are generous, and that it's good to be alive. Bodhi, hope requires laughter. May you live a life that is filled to the brim with evenings where you laugh until it hurts, where you snort because you can't contain yourself, and where milk gushes out of your nose as you say between shortened laughing breaths, it burns, why can't I stop laughing?" May you become intimate friends with life, with love, and with laughter. Which leads us to the definition of hope. Bodhi, I have found that the people who inspire me with their hope are people who live fully familiar lives with tears, sweat, and laughter. Now you can find each of these physiological functions in other mammals. Chimpanzees laugh, horses sweat, and elephants produce tears. But when we see another human being laughing, that audible phenomenon does something to our being. Laughter signals that another human is enjoying life, and we often want to jump headlong into their enjoyment with them. This is why watching funny movies with others is such a blast, and why watching funny movies alone is so isolating. A laughing audience is sharing something together. Now, sweat signals to other people that you are pushing yourself, that you are working hard to get the task at hand done, or even that you are under emotional stress. While sweat's baseline purpose is to be an evaporative cooling mechanism, in the human world, sweat is a social cue that says, I'm putting forth strenuous effort to make this happen. When we see another being working hard, there is an indescribable solidarity and appreciation for the labor of their hands. And when we see another human being crying, well, that's when our hearts can open in an infinite number of ways. According to the Italian biologist C.V. Bellini, several animals produce tears, but only humans produce tears in connection to their emotions. We call this psycho-emotional shedding of tears weeping. Tears have a way of invoking empathy in us because we are at our most human when we weep. Tears, sweat, and laughter. These requirements for hope are intimately tied to our humanness. 2 years ago at Loma Linda University Medical Center, you came into the world because of the courage and strength of your mother. Before, during, and after your birth, your mother perspired, she cried, and she even laughed. Your birth was a microcosm of the entire human experience. And 2,000 years ago, another baby boy was born. And I can imagine that Mary, before, during, and after the birth, perspired, cried, and laughed. The incarnation of God burst into the world between tears, sweat, and laughter. These three requirements are tied to our humanity. And it's in the very heart of our humanity that we find the divine, the life of Jesus. So Bodhi, after 35 years, the best definition of hope that I can give to you is this. Hope is consistent trust in the goodness of humanity. This is what your mother and I want for you. Throughout your life, we want you to believe that it is good for you to be alive, that the people around you bear the image of Christ, and that you have a sense that while they are imperfect people, they are ultimately good. In 2018, the world needs people of hope, people who consistently trust in the goodness of humanity. Humans can make a mess of things. We can be baited by power. We can try to conquer and domineer other human beings. We can threaten nuclear wars on Twitter. We can become authoritarians who start unlawful genocide. But humans can also build bridges. We can forgive. We can heal. We can love. And we can put the well-being of another ahead of our own well-being. The person of hope is one who can see all of humanity for what it is and insists that the goodness of our existence is worth fighting for. The most famous verse in the Bible is found in the Gospel of John. Jesus says that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. What that means is that God looked upon humanity, all of humanity, and responded with love. That is the hope of God. And that is the hope that your mother and I pray that you will discover. To my son, Bodhi, may you love your life, all of your life, between the tears, the sweat, and the laughter. May you be a person of hope. May you consistently trust in the goodness of humanity. And may you gain eyes to see that God is with us in our tears and in our triumphs. I am proud of you. I believe in you. And I love you. Sincerely, Dad.